On a black background, England, 1914. An image of a pocket watch on the palm of a hand emerges. It's 11:16. A second hand ticks round on a smaller dial on the watch. Blue sky dotted with clouds. A Rolls-Royce speeds through lush green countryside. The spokes of its wheels a blur. David Haig, Daniel Radcliffe, Carey Mulligan, Julian Wadham. The driver of the Rolls-Royce, a middle-aged man with gold-rimmed spectacles, a dark moustache and heavy eyebrows, checks his wristwatch. The spirit of ecstasy gleams on the bonnet above the mud-spattered grille. Martin McCann and Kim Catterall. Young men in suits sit on a bench holding documents. A man in naval uniform comes out to them.
Yellow forms, please.
The officer collects the forms.
Wait here.
One of the young men stares ahead. He has heavy dark eyebrows and wears gold-rimmed spectacles. The man in the Rolls-Royce, Rudyard Kipling, who wears a black Homburg, checks his watch again and motors on towards a palatial white building set behind trees. My boy Jack.
Are your people in the Navy?
No. Yours?
Oh yes, my father's captain of the Unity. What does yours do?
He's a writer.
The naval man's son looks down his nose.
John Kipling?
The bespectacled young man, John Kipling, rises from the bench. A naval officer holds the door open of a consulting room and John enters.
Come on, Kipling, where the hell are you?
King George, in uniform, studies the pocket watch. In the medical...
I'm a great admirer of your father's. Will you tell him I've just polished off Kim? Absolutely loved it.
Yes, I will, sir.
Wearing spectacles?
Yes, sir.
Shall we start with the eyes, then, and work backwards?
The Rolls-Royce speeds towards closed gates.
Allah's teeth, where are they? Oh, come on!
Gate men in uniform rush to open the grand wrought iron gates. The cream Rolls-Royce drives on through to tall wooden doors which are opened. The car pulls up in a bustling courtyard. Kipling gets out. A footman approaches.
His Majesty is expecting you, sir.
Thank you.
The footman takes his coat and Kipling strides off.
Don't worry, I have it about me. I shall catch you on the way up.
Thank you, sir.
Stand on the cross, please. Turn around and read the letters on the chart, starting at the top.
H-A-L.
Without the spectacles?
John Kipling removes his spectacles, blinks and bites his lip. Rudyard Kipling strides through a series of double doors opened for him by servants in red tailcoats. Spreading his arms wide, he enters an ornate room and clicks his heels together. King George V stands checking the watch. Kipling smiles expectantly.
2 hours, 57 minutes.
Yes! Ah, at last.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Your Majesty.
Marvellous run.
Awful close.
Whiskey?
It's a bit early.
Oh, bugger the time. Got to toast your triumph.
I've been tinkering with fourth gear. It adds a little something. Plus a new stretch of tarmac near Lamberhurst.
To the shattering of the three-hour barrier on the Bateman's Windsor Run.
To the Silver Ghost.
The Silver Ghost.
Bearded King George studies Kipling as they drink.
How's the family?
Well, as we speak, my son will be plumb in the middle of his medical for the Navy.
Ah, big day.
Absolutely. How's your youngest?
Not good. Big heart, weak body.
The King picks up a newspaper.
May I read you something?
Fire away.
This morning's Times. Rudyard Kipling, speaking yesterday at a meeting attended by more than 10,000 people, painted an alarming picture of life in this country under German rule.
Mm-hmm.
You think they'd invade?
I know they would, and our government will be there to welcome them ashore, soft-scented bloody tribe.
The Prime Minister has asked me to beg you, those were his words, to hold back at this sensitive time.
Why?
He believes there's still a chance of avoiding war.
He's wrong.
He thinks your pessimism is premature.
1 million German soldiers are sitting on the Belgian border, ready for the off. It depends how you define premature.
Right.
Our heads are buried in the sand, sir. We have a tiny professional army. Our weapons are 50 years old. If we don't get our skates on, we will pay the price.
But are you prepared to ease up a bit? At least in public?
Certainly not.
King George, wearing army uniform, smiles.
Glad to hear it. More whiskey?
A slender, middle-aged woman gardens beside an ornamental pond.
This is private property. You are trespassing. Please leave now.
Mrs. Kipling.
Now, please, and take your Kodaks with you.
Is Mr. Kipling available?
No, he is not available.
You British journalists are unbelievable. You treat my husband like a zoo animal. Now, if you really admire him so much, you would respect his privacy. How would you like it if I came tramping over your garden uninvited? Sir, you have a very distinctive face, and I would be happy to describe it to the police.
Leave, please.
She confiscates the photo they've taken, and they skulk away. Kipling to the footman's boy, whose leg's in a plaster cast.
The injured soldier.
Thank you for this, sir.
What an ever-so-impressive sight. How far did you fall?
15 feet.
Allah be praised. 15 feet is high. Did it hurt a great deal?
No.
That was a stroke of luck. Now, your father tells me you've read the first Jungle Book.
Yes.
But not the second.
No.
Here you are, Arthur.
Is Mowgli in it?
Every page is chock-a-block with Mowgli. And I've written your name and my name in the front so we don't forget who we are. And I've done a very silly picture of you plunging from your apple tree, but that's in pencil so you can rub it out as soon as I've gone.
Thank you.
Kipling's wife, Carrie, enters the house with roses.
Kodaks in the garden again. Did you see them off? Oh, yes. Well, that's good. Derry and Toms are selling women's underwear in the suffragette colours. Purple and green stripes.
Don't you dare.
She puts the roses beside a photo.
There you go, Josie.
I never imagine her ageing. She's always 7. But she's always older than me. Funny. She'll be 22 now.
And 32 days, exactly. Do you know what my mother used to call her? The little American.
Really?
Hmm. She spoke with an American accent until the day she died. Much to my mother's delight.
Jack! Jack!
Kipling arrives home and calls up the stairs.
Jack!
Kipling strides on through the old manor house and into the sitting room.
Where's the Admiral?
He's fixing the motorcycle with Peter.
Well, how did he get on?
They turned him down.
He wasn't allowed to wear his specs for the eye test.
For God's sake, do they want volunteers or not?
It seems sensible to me.
But wearing spectacles does not make one a bloody invalid.
I am
not rising to the bait. God, that is par for the course.
He marches out of the room.
Are you going down to see John, sir?
I am.
Could you tell Peter we'll be going home in 10 minutes?
I will indeed.
Kipling comes out of his baronial dwelling. A little boy in a flat cap is fixing a motorbike with John, or Jack, in a farmyard.
Peter, your mother wants you ready for the off in 10 minutes.
Really?
Really.
Peter looks pained and goes. Jack continues fixing the bike.
Don't be downhearted, old man.
I'm not.
Good. The Navy has always been tough on that sort of issue. We'll attack on another front.
What's the point of specs if you can't use them?
I know, it makes me spit blood. These people have no imagination. But we must buck up and look forwards. Did they realise who you were?
One of them did.
Right. Look, the army would be a completely different kettle of fish.
I wanted to join the Navy.
I know, but onwards, old man.
What if I organise a private examination with the Army Medical Board just as a preliminary canter? We could go together.
If I go, I can go on my own.
Of course you can, but a bit of support might be useful. Be worth it. If it tipped the balance, have a think about it.
Kipling squeezes his arm. Jack nods.
If you put her through her paces, let me know. I'd like to see how she's running.
Kipling holds the bike's handlebars.
I shall see you anon.
He gives Lum Jack a chummy nudge. Kipling addresses an audience.
If the Hun invades our shores, our English soul will be squashed and squeezed until it cries out in pain. The German will bring in his wake riot and starvation and bloodshed. The blood of our mothers and fathers, our wives, our sons and our daughters will drench the streets of our cities and paint our rivers red. And after the war is over, when the riots in London and Manchester and Liverpool are quelled, when our raped women are huddled and still, what then?
A note is brought to Kipling, who stops and reads it. Jack is in the audience and smiles up at his sister Bird, who's with their mother in a box. Kipling walks out onto the edge of the stage and looks grave.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have been informed that 10 minutes ago Great Britain declared war on Germany. Our army of 160,000 must now face a German army of 1.5 million. We must demand that every fit young man come forward to enlist.
Jack applauds.
And that every young man who chooses to remain at home be shunned by his community. Our unity, our strength, and our courage can save us from destruction.
The audience, many waving small Union Jacks, give him a standing ovation. A young man, Ralph, turns to Jack.
Wonderful speech. Sandhurst, here I come. When do you join the Navy, Jack?
Well, I've been thinking I'd see more action in the Army.
You can't change your tune.
I'm not sitting in the Channel while you're all doing your bit in Belgium.
They continue applauding enthusiastically. Jack stands wearing a pince-nez.
I can't get to grips with it.
Well, you must. A pince-nez gives a man a different expression as compared to spectacles.
If the army's desperate for recruits, they won't mind a pair of specs. It doesn't suit me.
Yes, it does.
Does it?
I think it's good. Now, I wonder if you shouldn't brush your hair back away from the face. You've got a high forehead. It'd be a shame to waste it.
What's a high forehead got to do with this?
It's a sign of intelligence.
It can't be.
I'm assured it is.
No, it's too loose. I'm not wearing it.
Will it really make a difference to his chances?
It's a medical, not a costume parade.
Jack, I'm sure you're going to sail into the army, but your eyes are a serious issue and the overall impression will be vital. You've got to take a big pull on yourself and really dig out.
Kipling eyes Jack sternly. He puts the pince-nez back on the bridge of Jack's nose.
See if that's a snugger fit.
He tilts Jack's head back a little. Jack stares stonily at him.
Better?
Probably.
Good. Have a stroll around the room, see how it feels.
Carrie lowers her eyes as Jack obeys, then whips off the pince-nez and turns impatiently.
I'm not wearing it! Jack!
Carrie shakes her head.
He'll do more harm than good.
He is not a boy. He is a young man. If you continue to pamper him, he will turn into something altogether weak and watery.
Well, if he's a young man, he's old enough to make his own decision.
This is absolutely his own decision, but I want him to make the most of...
You want?
For his sake. It's Jack's future.
Precisely.
No, I'm not going to argue.
Red, his eyes are not an excuse. The Navy gave him 5 minutes. Do you really think it's fair to encourage him?
I would think it very unfair if I didn't.
Carrie considers, then smiles resignedly. She walks out, sedately carrying a flower basket. At the medical.
Breathe in. And out. This shouldn't take long. It's all standard stuff. Quick look at the ears.
I've always wondered, Kipling.
Other ear?
How on earth do you think up the story?
Well, inventing the story isn't the problem. It's putting the jigsaw together afterwards that can be trouble.
Pants down, please.
Oh, it's the structure is a bit tricky, is it?
Mm.
My son's just polished off the Jungle Books. Absolutely love them. Cough? I suppose you've read all your father's books.
I've never read the Jungle Books.
I don't believe it. Cough again? Jolly good. Pants up.
Clean bill of health?
Yes, fighting fit. Just the eye test and we can relax. Spectacles off.
It's a pince-nez, actually.
From the top, off you go.
Everything blurs.
I can't see anything, I'm afraid.
Nothing? Would you walk towards the board and stop when you can clearly read the top letter?
Jack walks until he can see the letters T, Q, U.
T, Q, U.
And the next line?
Jack moves nearer still to the board.
Y, O, W.
After the test.
This is very serious myopia. We couldn't possibly...
There are very strict guidelines.
I think Colonel Brooks would agree we were prepared to stretch a point.
Indeed, but there has to be a limit.
If he lost his spectacles, he'd be a danger to himself.
And to his men.
I'm very sorry.
So am I. You haven't given the boy a chance. It's precisely the sort of inflexibility this country needs to get out of its system. John has so much to offer. It's a great shame.
I agree, I do agree.
Well, clearly you don't, or we'd be looking for a way forward. Nothing you can do. Hmm? Well, I'm not calling it a day. I shall write. I think it's utterly gutless. It's so spineless. Come on, John. We're off. My son's commitment is second to none. He deserves this opportunity and he will get it.
Jack leaves. Kipling storms after him. Night. The cream rolls pulls up at the entrance to Kipling's grand stone residence. The chauffeur opens the gates. Jack and his father get out of the back of the car and Jack stomps off.
Jack!
Jack strides past his mother in a shadowy hallway.
Jack!
Kipling enters and removes his hat and coat.
I'm sorry.
No, you're not. You're absolutely delighted.
Jack enters a shadowy drawing room. He takes a packet of cigarettes and matches out from behind a book on a shelf and puts a cigarette in his mouth. He isn't aware of Bird on a nearby sofa.
Best beloved brother.
Bird. They turned me down.
I guessed. Can I have a puff?
She kneels, looking at him over the back of the sofa.
Don't you hate this room? There's not one comfortable chair in the whole bloody building.
It's true.
I have to get out of this house. I can't bear it. I can't bear being G'd up and encouraged.
Better than being criticised.
No, it's not. You see, you don't understand. I have to be with other people.
Oh, thank you.
No, not you. I don't want to leave you. I just... I want to be myself, that's all. Oh, let's stop this, it's boring. Shall we have a whiskey?
Why not?
She has the cigarette. He pours the whiskey into cut glass tumblers.
What shall we drink to?
Us.
He hands her a drink and takes back the cigarette.
Best beloved sister.
Best beloved brother.
He hands the cigarette back to Bird.
Don't you dare leave me alone, all right?
She looks him in the eye.
Promise me you won't.
He returns her gaze.
Jack?
Bird hurriedly ducks down onto the sofa with the cigarette and drinks. Kipling enters.
It's very dark in here.
I suppose it is.
Kipling approaches him, smiling.
No need to be despondent about today.
I'm not giving up. I can join the ranks.
Well, hold your horses.
I'll do whatever it takes, Daddo.
There are other avenues we can explore.
What other avenues? What can you do now? No, I'm going to join the ranks.
Don't
jump the gun.
I'm not jumping the gun. What a stupid phrase that is.
Jack, let me look into it first. If that doesn't work, we'll consider your option. All right.
Jack nods tightly. Bird listens. Kipling moves closer to Jack.
I'm thrilled you're so keen. And terribly proud. We'll get there. So.
He hugs Jack to him.
Hold on, old man.
Jack winces as his father squeezes him, then lets him go. He stares at Jack for a moment, then lowers his eyes and makes for the door. Kipling turns back, smiles and leaves. Bird pops up with the cigarette.
Very solemn.
She hands the cigarette to him. Bird ducks.
You will put out that cigarette before you go up, won't you?
Kipling smiles and leaves again. Taken aback, Jack smiles. Day. Carrie helps Kipling on with his overcoat.
Nobody supports the war more passionately than I do. You know that. But we've pushed him far enough. He feels he's failed. Talk to Ferguson at the War Office. There must be a job there which would make him feel valued, and he'd be working with others in the same situation. He wouldn't be so alone.
It'd be clerical.
Well, if it has to be.
She eyes him seriously.
Will you do that for me? Please.
He nods faintly, then looks at his watch.
I must go.
He kisses her on the cheek. She hands him gloves.
Thank you.
He goes. Attractive, dark-haired Carrie stares ahead thoughtfully. Kipling, attaché case under one arm, puts on his Homburg as he walks towards a gate where the Rolls is waiting. It glides away, leaving the house bathed in sunlight. Propaganda Committee, War Office. A white-haired uniformed man, Colonel Ferguson, approaches a door with a sign on it, Meeting in Progress. He enters, marches to a table where Kipling is with two other men in civvies, sits and speaks.
I have the British casualty figures for the first day of the battle for Aubert Ridge. 458 officers and 11,161 men.
On the first day.
I'm afraid so.
I can't announce that to the House. The effect on morale will be disastrous.
This is precisely the kind of issue the Prime Minister wants us to tackle. If our brief is to tell the truth, but a truth which is bearable to the British people, do we dilute the figures?
I think we have to.
Or do we camouflage them by emphasising the scale of the victory?
Assuming that is that our troops took Aubert Ridge.
I'm afraid they didn't.
Kipling's eyes flit around. He holds a lit cigarette.
The people should hear the truth. These figures will wake up every young man who's sitting at home twiddling his thumbs. He will read these and know his duty is to the men who've already sacrificed their lives. More effective than any recruiting speech. Publish the figures in the Times. I'll come up with some words to accompany.
The Rolls pulls up outside elegant stone townhouses with flights of steps leading up to them. The chauffeur gets out to open the rear door for Kipling, who gets out and jogs up the steps to one of the houses and stands at the dark painted front door. A woman wearing a nurse's uniform opens up.
Good morning, sir. Field Marshal Roberts is expecting you.
Thank you.
The Field Marshal sits in a wheelchair.
The Boers taught us a simple lesson. In modern warfare, there are three vital ingredients. Speed, surprise, and variety. So what do? We give the Hun plenty of warning. We load our boys up like Christmas trees. And we forbid them to run. Recipe for disaster.
Kipling reaches for a glass of water and hands it to him. White-haired Robertson sips it and hands the glass back to him.
What can I do for you, Kipling?
Bobs, I've come to ask a favour.
Jack, his dark hair parted on one side and slicked down, sits smoking in a bar.
Hello, Jack. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Ralph.
Ralph's in uniform.
I got you a pint.
Thanks. God, I'm looking forward to this. Cheerio.
Jack, in a tweed jacket, sips his pint. Ralph takes several large, thirsty glugs of his. Jack puffs his cigarette.
So how's Sandhurst?
Splendid. Really splendid. Hard work, but the spirit is wonderful. We can't wait to get to France.
When will you go?
Join my regiment next week, so soon, I hope. Why the delay with you?
Oh, it's nothing. There are one or two issues.
Issues?
Choosing a regiment, that sort of thing.
Jack lowers his eyes and puffs on his cigarette. Ralph looks over at a group of soldiers.
They're from the Royal Sussex. They fought at Wipers. It's probably their first leave.
Jack looks embarrassed. Trees cast dappled sunlight as Jack, wearing helmet, goggles and overcoat, speeds along a country road on his Douglas motorbike. He rides through the gates to Bateman's, the Kipling's house, gets off his bike and rests it on its stand. A telegram boy approaches.
I've just delivered something for you.
Jack runs to the house. He rushes into the large hallway, removes his gloves and picks up a telegram from a silver platter on a refectory table. He opens the telegram hurriedly and reads it.
Yes! Thank you, Dallow!
You march up to one of your powerful pals...
That's enough!
...who's on the point of conking out.
Leave it, Bert!
No, I won't! Mother, did you know about this?
No, I didn't.
Why is he suddenly fit to fight?
I'm in the room. I'm not a cripple.
We are at war. Criteria change.
Rubbish. He can't see 5 yards without his specs. What was the point of those examinations? Totally humiliating, and they all said the same thing. It's too dangerous. Well, frankly, Father, it will be your fault if Jack is killed.
She turns away.
Get out.
Bird remains where she is.
You should have told me, Red.
Neither of you understand what is at stake.
Yes, we do.
I don't think so. What this country has achieved over the last 150 years is unique. We have built up, painstakingly built up, a family of nations.
Oh, please, Father.
Will you listen to me? A family of nations. And Britain, as parents, mother and father, has an absolute duty to protect its children.
You're protecting the wrong family, Father.
A tearful Bird flounces out.
I'm sorry the War Office couldn't come up with something, but I'm sure you did your best.
Kipling bristles. He lays a hand on Jack's shoulder.
Mother...
She turns to Jack and smiles tenderly.
Congratulations, Jack.
She goes to hug him. Her brow is furrowed as she rests her chin on his shoulder, then draws back.
Now, you and I must sit down and make a list of what you're going to need.
Jack looks to his father.
Go on.
Carrie follows her son out. Kipling's dark eyes flit around and he looks sad. 2nd Battalion, Irish Guards. The gates to the barracks open, and a group of men in civvies with cases under their arms enter the parade ground where troops are being drilled. Jack rides in on his motorcycle. He lifts his goggles and, still wearing spectacles, looks around and smiles. In the family farmyard, Bird watches cows being herded.
I can't bear it.
But we've always had Guernseys.
Not anymore, Bird.
If we're going to produce food for the troops, we have to do it properly. We'll keep one small herd of shorthorns for beef. Otherwise, the whole estate will be turned over to root crops.
Right. And what can we do to help, Hobden?
Start digging, Miss Kipling.
Come on, you fucking nuts!
Jack in bayonet practice.
You're supposed to stop that gun! No! Tickle him to death! No! Is that all you got? Come on! Quickly!
Jack adjusts his specs.
This is no time for personal grooming, Kipling! Get your scrawny arse back in line!
Jack straightens and marches.
Come on!
back!
Hobden helps women onto a cart at Bateman's.
Come along, Mrs. Clark. Best foot forward. Up and to your left. Mrs. Wilson, up and to your right now. Miss Kipling, up and to your left. Mrs. Kipling, up to your right, thank you.
A cart horse pulls the women away. Holding an assortment of hoes, spades and forks, the women chat merrily. Kipling is with the propaganda committee, listening to a report.
80% of British shells were defective or duds. Our guns were so outdated and worn out that our shells fell short of the German lines, killing our own wounded, lying in no man's land. The few British troops to survive the battle ran back towards safety, taking with them a number of German prisoners. Our troops believed it to be an enemy counterattack and opened fire, killing all but a handful of our own men.
Kipling's hand trembles as he holds his spectacles. Jack is among soldiers lying on their stomachs and aiming their rifles over sandbags. An officer, Corporal O'Leary, patrols behind them in the pouring rain. He squats down behind Jack and watches as he aims at the target board.
Come on, Kipling, you can do better than that.
He's missed. Jack wipes the rain off his spectacles, which slip down his nose. Jack hits the ground in front of the target. Teeth clenched, he pushes his spectacles back up, cocks his gun, and aims. He hits the ground once more and looks frustrated. Kipling's Rolls-Royce glides along a winding country road set in rolling, sunny countryside. Kipling is asleep in the back of the car. His spectacles have fallen off his nose and onto his chest. At the Kipling home, mother and daughter, still in their work clothes, are asleep on a sofa. Golden sunlight filters into the room where Carrie sits asleep and Bird lies with her legs tucked beneath her. The palms of the women's hands are covered in cold cream. At his barracks, Jack, wearing spectacles, takes a piece of putty out of a drawer and tears off a chunk. He puts what he's taken into a case with a pair of spectacles in it, closes the case, and puts it in his uniform flat hat. He walks down a shadowy corridor and out to the firing range where Corporal O'Leary stands by a brazier, which burns brightly in the night.
Thank you for this, O'Leary.
Not at all, sir.
O'Leary hands him a rifle. Jack takes it, then puts the putty round the bridge of his spare pair of spectacles and puts them on. He lies down, cocks his rifle, and takes aim.
"72, sir."
Jack nods, then tries again. He hits the outer ring, then the next ring further on in the target. He almost hits the center.
"Better, sir. 81.
He beams. At home.
"Come here.
It's my turn to read."
"No, it certainly is not."
Kipling grabs a letter off Bird and sits between her and Carrie on a sofa to read it.
"Dear old things plus Bird, as you can see from the enclosed photo, I am no longer a mewling, squawking cadet, but a fully fledged, highly commissioned officer."
"Let me see."
"You are looking at Second Lieutenant John Kipling." "Show me."
"Doesn't he look fine?"
"Corporal O'Leary has prodded me and pushed me and knocked me into shape. He tells me I am now ready to command men. Raw recruits arrive from Dublin any day now. 20 of them will be my platoon. It's my job to turn them into hard-bitten professional soldiers."
Jack dons his uniform.
"I am more windy about meeting them than about going over the top."
Jack studies himself in a mirror. Jack turns from the mirror and O'Leary salutes him.
"So, 5 platoon is waiting outside, so."
Jack salutes back. Outside, a group of men in civvies sit glumly. O'Leary leads Jack out.
"Officer!
On your feet, just easy, bastards! Up!"
"I am Lieutenant Kipling. I'm your platoon commander. Together, we are 5 platoon, 2 company, 2nd battalion Irish Guards. Before you start your training, I want to ask you all a question. It's very simple. Why did you join the army?" "You."
"Me, sir? To see the world, sir?
King and country, sir.
Money.
Jack walks on up the line and stops in front of a young man.
Safer for me to fight the Germans than be at home in Dublin just at the minute, if you know what I mean, sir.
The thing is, whatever your reasons, you all volunteered. No one forced you to be here, and in a week's time, when you want to shoot me in the head, I'd like you to remember that. But I promise you one thing. I won't ask you to do anything I wouldn't do myself.
Press-ups.
28. 29. 30.
What's the matter, Dilly? Are you tired? Would you like a nice cup of tea?
33.
Come on, you shovel of shakes.
34.
Are you all totally bloody useless?
35.
Jack is doing the press-ups with his men and making it look easy.
38, 39, 40!
I think you should stop now, sir. You're embarrassing these ladies.
On your feet!
The men struggle to their feet. Jack puts on his specs with the putty to keep them secure, then dons his uniform cap. His men, lying flat on their stomachs with their rifles resting on sandbags, turn to look at him. Jack takes up position to fire.
Action! Commence firing! Commence firing! Guardsman Dilly, 52. Guardsman Doyle, 48. Guardsman Bow, 58. Guardsman McHugh, 77. Lieutenant Kipling, 93.
His men turn and look at him with admiration. Jack rides his motorcycle in sunshine, his coattails flapping behind him. He rides into the driveway at home. Carrie and Bird draw back a curtain. Kipling is behind, wearing a fez and sitting with the palms of his hands together in a praying position. He has an audience of children.
I would like to tell you how the rhino got his skin. I am the Parsi Pastonji Bamonji, sitting in my palm tree, and you are all rhinoceri, which is what happens when there is more than one rhinoceros. And you have all come down for a bathe on the shores of the Red Sea. But to do that, you must remove your skins. Unbutton your skins, please.
They remove jackets.
Sit on your skins, please. Now, let me return you to the beginning. Once upon a time on an... Lieutenant Kipling.
Down on the floor, please. Remove your skin.
And sit upon it.
Jack, now sporting a moustache, removes his army greatcoat and sits on the floor.
Hello, Peter. Once upon a time... on an uninhabited island, there lived a Parsi from whose hat the rays of the sun were reflected in more than oriental splendour.
What do you think of the moustache, Mother? You look older.
Is that a good thing?
Of course it is.
I may be biased, but I like it.
You look very... dashing. Kit does. You look very handsome.
He looks very smug to me. You've got a secret. What is it?
The battalion sails next week. I'm going to France.
But why now? Couldn't they have given you any warning?
Well, we knew it was coming.
But it's so sudden.
That's good news, old man. The waiting's over.
So this is your last weekend?
Yes.
Shocked. Bird looks down. Carrie gets up sharply and walks across the room. Kipling watches her gently. She stands holding the back of a chair, her brow furrowed and her chest heaving. Father and son have a drink in Kipling's study.
Here's to you, old man. You must be awfully excited.
I am.
I wish I could be in your shoes now.
Take one of mine, Dad.
Jack offers a cigarette.
Thank you.
Kipling takes one, sits down on a chair opposite Jack and watches him. Jack strikes a match. He lights Kipling's cigarette, then his own. Kipling coughs.
Mind you, I must give up. It does the inside cupboards no good at all. Have they told you where you're going?
Not officially. But we know how much hangs on it. I shouldn't tell you this, but the Great Advance kicks off on August the 17th.
Your birthday?
Exactly. General Haking says it'll be the greatest battle in the history of the world.
Right.
It's possible we may leave a few days before my birthday. I wondered if you'd write a letter to the regiment, giving me permission to go over before I'm 18.
Kipling raises his eyebrows in admiration.
The greatest battle in the history of the world.
Well, I don't want to miss it. I want to be in the thick of it.
Of course you do.
Kipling smiles proudly and fondly. He gets up and reaches for a pen and paper.
Who am I writing to?
Jack and Peter.
I have got some important things to give you. First and foremost, a bar of chocolate.
Can I eat it now?
Which you can eat now. Secondly, the key to my shed.
My own key?
Your own key. Do not lose it. And thirdly, a list of things to be getting on with.
I want you to read it to me now so you'll absolutely know what's to be done.
Wearing a sailor suit, Peter opens the list.
1. Oil the chain. Once a week. Not too much oil. 2. Clean the plugs. I don't know how to.
Which is precisely what I'm going to show you.
When you come back.
Yes?
Will you bring me something?
What do you fancy?
A German shell?
I shall try.
The Rolls waits at the Kipling's side gate. Kipling paces outside a door which has a stone arch over it. He checks his watch and hurries inside. Carrie helps Jack pack.
Have you packed your spare glasses?
Yes.
Show me.
He digs the glasses case out and opens it.
Good.
Jack! You ought to leave!
Coming.
Carrie holds his coat for him to put it on.
You look so fine. How do you get those buttons so shiny? They're like mirrors.
Someone does it for me, that's how. Don't worry. Corporal O'Leary will look after me.
Well, I'll blame him then if anything happens to you.
Jack! We're up against it!
I'm off.
He and his mother hug tightly.
I won't come down.
All right.
They draw back. Jack breathes in deeply and turns to collect his belongings. He then looks Carrie firmly in the eye.
Be careful.
I will. Bye.
His nostrils flare and his jaw clenches as he turns away from her and heads out. Carrie, her features etched with anguish, sits on his bed and stares into the distance. Doe-eyed Bird waits at the bottom of the stairs as Jack comes down.
Bye, Bird.
They exchange a brief kiss, then hug. Kipling appears.
Come on, old man.
Look after yourself.
Go, Jack. Go on.
Jack goes. Kipling gives Bird a sad, tender look, then follows Jack out. Father and son, both with moustaches and glasses, walk down the garden path together, looking straight ahead. Kipling is balding. The chauffeur comes to take Jack's luggage.
Thank you.
Kipling and Jack turn to face each other and Kipling offers his hand.
Good luck. Bye, Dada.
They shake hands and Kipling puts his left hand over their already joined hands. Jack turns and walks to the gate grimly. He stops and turns back to his father.
16 officers from Worley Barracks have died already. And Ralph, killed on his first day. Frightening, a bit.
Kipling takes him by the shoulders.
Of course it is. You'll be all right.
The sooner I get out there, the better.
Absolutely.
Bye.
Bye.
Kipling smiles gently, as if trying to reassure his tense son, who returns his gaze steadily. Jack turns and gets into the waiting car. Jack waves at Bird, who stands on the doorstep, biting back tears. She waves bravely. The Rolls drives away. Kipling steps out into the road and raises his arm to wave Jack off. Carrie sits motionless on Jack's bed, staring ahead. Bird, a slender, fresh-complexioned girl with her hair piled on top of her head, goes back inside glumly. Kipling stands in the road, motionless. Luz, Northern France. A rat scuttles through muddy trenches. Enemy shells blast smoking craters into the sodden earth. Wooden planks and corrugated iron hold up the trenches, which are lined on top with sandbags and encompassed by crisscrossed struts of wood. Rain pours as Jack leads his men through a trench. A man being carried on a stretcher stops Jack. The young man, whose eyes are covered by a bloody bandage, releases his grip and is carried on. Bedraggled, weary men sit on makeshift benches in the trench. Jack walks on with his men. Kipling, in waistcoat and shirt sleeves, steps into his sunny farmyard and sees Bird and Carrie at work.
That's a heavy one.
Over to you, Mr. Kipling.
News from the Warrior!
Oh! Let me see!
How is he?
On good form, actually. Very wet, but in good spirits.
A letter.
Bonjour, all things plus Bird. Just a hurried line to tell you I am A1. I have never been so fit. We march 60 miles in 36 hours. It is raining here like Hades. Will you send me an oilskin coat, one of those black things that the sailors wear in the North Sea? Could you try it on first, Dad? It must be good and roomy. The Germans seem to be getting into their stride here, but we'll be ready. We'll write again soon if we ever stop marching. Dear love, John.
They look downcast.
60 miles. You must be exhausted.
Hearing the noise, they look up.
Is that thunder?
It sounds like it.
No, the wind has changed. It's from the south. From France.
They listen for the shells. Beau has a foot oozing pus.
I'd rather go over the top than examine your feet three times a week, Beau.
Oh, my feet are delightful. I wouldn't mind the gangrene sitting in, and they'd be after whisking me away to a nice warm hospital bed.
Jesus. I bet there's creatures in there having the meal of their lives. Look at this, sir.
Jack inspects the inflamed sore.
That must hurt.
It does, sir. Is it the trench foot?
No.
No, the foot's a good colour. Did you powder me, Doyle?
Fuck off.
Bring it here. Thank you, sir.
Jack massages powder into Beau's foot.
Oh, Jesus Christ, that feels good. Oh, Jesus, that's lovely.
Jesus. I've just had a terrible image of you in bed with your wife, Bob.
They all duck as rubble rains down on them.
Jesus, fuck!
Oh, God, that was close.
O'Leary looks out of a periscope at the battlefield, black with smoke and dotted with bright flames.
Any sign of Jerry?
No, sir.
O'Leary climbs down.
Your feet are important to me, Beau. I want them fit to dance a victory jig in the German trenches.
Night at the Kiplings. Kipling opens a bottle of champagne and raises it.
To Jack.
Carrie and Bird stand somberly.
We're thinking of you, old man. It would be a happier birthday if you were here with us at Bateman's. But we're awful proud. And wish you all the luck in the world.
He pours glasses for all of them.
Happy birthday, Jack. Happy birthday, Jack.
Happy birthday, Jack.
Jack smoking in a trench.
Happy birthday to you. Happy
birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Ben Kipling. Happy birthday to you.
Thanks, boys.
Jack waves his tin mug at them. Captain Viney walks up to him.
Have a birthday present for you, Kipling.
When do we go over, sir?
Tomorrow morning. 7:30.
Jack nods firmly. Viney walks away. A bedraggled Jack stands staring down, cigarette in hand.
Upton suggests we grow a white cabbage called Holland Lake during the winter. Apparently it's the only brassica that will stand the journey. Do you agree? Right?
He gets into bed with her.
I'm sorry, I wasn't...
Is that important?
She puts down her book and lies on her side.
Do you want a story?
No, thank you.
Kipling thinks for a moment, then turns and reaches for a book. Sitting up in bed, he settles back, removes his glasses and starts to read. He stops almost immediately, letting the book drop to his stomach and scrunching up his eyes. He then stares ahead pensively. A flare is launched into night sky. It descends in a globe of golden light.
Dear old things plus bird. Funny to think one will be in the thick of it tomorrow. One's first experience of shellfire in the open. It is great luck that my first action shall be such an important one. You have no idea what enormous issues depend on the next few days. If we succeed, the war won't go on for long. We won't have any time for writing, so this may be my last letter for some time. So long, old dears. Dear love, John.
Jack sits writing in the shadows of his Spartan quarters in a trench. Rainwater cascades off the roof. He finishes writing and stares into the darkness ahead of him. Carrie stirs in bed, then wakes and sees Kipling is no longer beside her. She sits up and draws back the bedclothes. Wearing a long nightdress and a coat draped over her shoulders, Carrie comes out into the dawn light. She walks across the lawn to join Kipling sitting on a bench seat beside the ornamental pond. He's wearing pyjamas and dressing gown. They stare into the grey light. Jack checks his watch.
10 minutes, O'Leary.
O'Leary nods and walks away.
10 minutes! Check your weapons! Chins up, lads! Gas mask!
Strap over! McHugh, help me get
the
strap over.
McHugh! Fuck off, Bo!
McHugh checks his rifle.
Jesus Christ, my gun's blocked. Shit, there's mud in the barrel. Oh God, I've got to clean it out.
McHugh tries to pee down the barrel.
Come on!
Don't piss in my direction, you filthy bastard.
Don't be pointing that scabby cock at me. Shit, come on. I've been shitting and pissing all day and now I can't go.
Jack stands with his jaw set firm and staring ahead. At home, Kipling, Carrie and Bird sit round a table. All are wearing night attire and sit statue-like, lost in gloomy thought. China teacups are laid out on the table before them.
Listen! When you go over, you will see chalk pit wood 500 yards ahead of you. Advance straight to the trees. 5 platoon has been instructed to take pigeon baskets. It is of A1 importance that you hold on to these until you get to the German trenches.
What are they for, sir?
When you reach the enemy trenches, you will release your pigeon. It will then fly back to HQ, and senior officers will be alerted that we have done our job. 2 minutes.
Are you supposed to climb out of the trench? Let alone fucking run.
Sir! What?
Sir, my pigeon's dead, sir.
What?
My pigeon's dead, what shall I do?
Well, how do you know it's dead?
It's lying at the bottom of the basket, sir. It's not moving.
Oh, for God's sake.
Do I have to take the basket across, sir, if the pigeon's dead?
Well, no, if you're sure it's dead, then no, of course not.
Sure, I dump the basket?
Yes, just dump the bloody basket, Bo.
Bo shuffles edgily. Rain drips from the peak of his cap. The line of men look terrified. Jack checks his watch.
1 minute. Fix bayonets!
Oh, Mother of God. I can't do it. My fingers won't work.
Jack coolly helps Beau attach the bayonet.
Thank you, sir.
Square-shouldered, Jack returns to his position and faces his men in the torrential rain. Craggy-faced O'Leary raises a shaking hand to his lips to kiss his wedding ring. Jack begins to climb a ladder out of the trench. He stops halfway and turns to his men.
Front rank, about turn!
They turn to face the ladders. O'Leary, steeled for action, watches Jack intently. Jack takes a whistle from his top pocket and puts it between his lips. Pistol in one hand, he checks his watch. The men wait grimly. Jack looks down the ranks of his men somberly. The peak of Beau's cap shakes as he trembles. Jack and his men scale the ladders and run into a barrage of shells which explode around them in the mud. Black smoke rises into the dull sky, and pockets of flame glow on the battlefield, where corpses decay and artillery is abandoned. Jack dodges fallout from a shell. The men become silhouettes in the smoke of battle. The Kipling's house, Bateman's, with its tall chimneys and manicured lawns, stands in lush wooded countryside. A cyclist pedals slowly along a road towards the house. The cyclist, a telegram boy, stops at the side gate, props his bike up against the high hedge, and approaches the gate gingerly. He pauses before going through. Inside the house, Kipling sits reading a book. Kipling puts his book down and his spectacles on. Looking tense, he walks steadily towards the door. He hesitates before opening the door.
Telegram, Mr. Kipling.
Kipling takes it and maintains a dignified, polite expression. The boy, wearing a round peaked cap and navy blue uniform, lowers his eyes, then turns and walks away. Kipling watches him sadly. Kipling turns away, pauses, then goes back inside. Blinking back tears, he walks glumly through the grand hallway. Hearing noises, he pauses to consider, then walks towards the large wooden staircase and climbs a few steps to his study. In waistcoat and shirt sleeves, Kipling slowly removes the telegram from his trouser pocket. He stares at the envelope and shudders. His trembling hand hesitates before opening the envelope. Kipling slides out the folded telegram. A strip on the outside reads, Number 2 Infantry. Inside, part of the message reads, Missing, presumed injured.
Is that the post?
Kipling regains his composure.
No. He is not dead.
Jack.
He is missing. Believed wounded. He might not be seriously hurt. He may very well have strolled into HQ by now, and he may have got lost. That happens fairly frequently, you know.
She weeps as she reads the telegram.
We should have stopped him.
Kipling stares at her sadly.
I'm back! Hello?
Hello, Bert.
Complete success. One spare Aurelux battery, one edition Tatler, and, this will please him, one pair of good bedroom slippers.
Bird's smile fades when she turns and looks at her parents.
He's been killed.
No. No, he's missing.
Missing?
Believed wounded.
He'll come home then. He'll be fine.
Bird turns away and begins to wrap the slippers.
Bird.
Why did you let him go?
I didn't let him go. He went because he wanted to.
You missed the point. God, you just... You've no idea. Don't you realise he didn't give a damn about your cause? The reason he went to get his head shot off was to get away from us. To escape this dark, depressing house. To be rid of us, to be rid of home. What does that do to your theories, Father? Is that reason enough to fight? Is that an honourable sacrifice? Is it? Is it? I don't think so.
Tears stream down her cheeks and she looks away, stunned. Kipling stares at her. Carrie and Bird sit holding hands on a wall seat in the porchway to the house. Bird stares down at the ground. Carrie stares stoically into the distance. Kipling enters the War Office.
10 columns of British infantry attacked along a 6 and a...
I'm sorry I'm late.
Attaché case under his arm, he walks to a table. The others stand beside a plan on a blackboard.
We were just discussing the Battle of Loos. I don't want you to...
Not at all, no. I still have a very hazy view of the facts. I'd appreciate a more detailed picture. Carry on, please.
He gets out documents and sits down.
Please.
The three other men, looking awkward, go to the table. Colonel Ferguson lays down his baton and begins to read his report as he sits down.
The British bombardment was ineffective, and we ran out of shells after 90 minutes. German machine gun posts were undamaged. 385 officers and 7,861 men were killed or wounded in the first attack. The Germans already refer to the battle as the Field of Corpses. A further 600 Irish and Scots guards were declared missing, believed wounded. A substantial number of British troops were taken prisoner. We are investigating reports that these prisoners are being treated in an inhumane manner. However, in some places, up to 2,000 yards of enemy territory was taken. In spite of the cost, Loos was a victory.
Kipling, maintaining a brave face, presses his palms together and looks relieved as he brings his fingertips to his mouth. Kipling arrives home.
I've had a good day. A good day. Would you like to hear what I've achieved?
Yes, please.
I have arranged meetings at the Irish Guard Depot and Swiss Red Cross.
Mm-hmm.
And I have written to the War Office and 5 hospitals I know that have wards of wounded troops. What do you think?
Excellent.
And I have written you a list of people that I think you should contact to speed things up. You use your influence to get Jack into the army. You can use your influence to find him now. I'm going to the post office.
We have more than 4,000 photographs of prisoners in Germany.
Could you send us a copy of those?
All of them?
We'll only need the recent ones.
No, I'd like to see all of them, please. Thank you so much for your time.
They leave the Red Cross. At the barracks,
One shouldn't necessarily expect the worst. All the information we're receiving about the battle points to a deal of confusion.
I'd like to contact you on a daily basis.
We'll get in touch with you if there's any news.
No, I'd like to do it. What would be the best time to telephone?
The Rolls-Royce speeds along a woodland road, the lush leaves creating a canopy above it. At home, the Kiplings lie glumly in bed, he on his side facing away, she on her back. Both stare ahead, deep in thought. Carrie undoes a brown paper parcel tied up with string. She empties hundreds of black and white photographs of soldiers from it onto a table. Carrie runs her hands over the photos, spreading them over the drawing room table, then pulling them together. She sifts through, looking at each image. Carrie sits forlornly, looking down at the mass of photos in front of her. Looking more determined, Carrie now has the photographs arranged into neat piles. She sits and studies one.
No.
She hands it to Kipling.
No.
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 Day turns to night. Kipling sits back in his chair wearily.
We'll go through them once again.
Oh.
He stubs out his cigarette.
Let's do them tomorrow.
I'll check them once again.
Let's do them tomorrow. We need to sleep.
Go to bed then.
Hands on hips, Kipling stares at the floor.
All right. Come on. We'll check them again.
No, not if you're going to Hufflepuff. I'd rather do it on my own.
Carrie, we'll check them again. Pass me a photograph.
No.
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 Day. Walking under a black umbrella, Kipling opens a huge wooden door and enters the farmyard on his estate. He stands staring ahead wistfully. Hearing a noise, he turns and sees Peter polishing Jack's motorbike.
You work long hours.
Look.
Kipling closes his umbrella and enters the open-fronted shed where Jack's motorbike stands.
That is the cleanest motorcycle I have ever seen. How long did it take?
All afternoon.
I'm not surprised. Does your mother know you're here?
Yes.
Let's have a cup of tea and I'll walk you home.
Kipling goes into a nearby shed with a door and windows. He takes a match from a silver holder and lights a primus stove. Peter appears in the doorway.
Can we have a story?
Good idea.
Kipling puts a kettle on the stove.
This is a tale of Captain Jack Kipling and Lieutenant Peter Carter. That's you. Of the Bengal Lancers, finest cavalry officers of their generation. Straight-backed, tight-kneed, keen-eyed, they patrol the Grand Trunk Road. Have you heard of that great road?
No.
It is the longest road in India, the backbone of all Hindustan. 1,500 miles and straight as a ruler. All castes and kinds of men move here. It is a river of life. All the world going and coming. But all the world stops to watch Lieutenant Peter Carter and...
Sitting round a stone block with a teapot on it, Peter looks up sadly at Kipling, then lowers his eyes. Kipling's face crumples and he begins to weep. He takes off his spectacles.
And Captain Jack Kipling dropped by.
Is Jack dead?
Not certain, old man, not certain at all.
Peter and Kipling sit glumly holding their mugs of tea.
Not even sure he should have gone in the first place.
Kipling starts to put his glasses back on, but decides to drink his tea instead. He then puts the mug down and sits forlornly.
One more tiny question. Where did you see him? Was it the southern end or the northern end of Chalk Pit Wood?
It's difficult to be precise.
Let me help you.
Carrie.
Just a minute, right. At the southern end, there's a large pond between the edge of the wood and the chalk escarpment. Now, in order to circle the wood, you have to pass the pond. Does that ring a bell?
It does, yes. I definitely passed a pond.
Well, that's very useful. Thank you, Captain Bruce. You've been incredibly helpful.
I'm delighted to have been some use.
Oh, you definitely have. Let me find my daughter and she'll show you out.
Thank you.
Right through here.
Bruce's forehead is badly scarred. Alone, Kipling bows his head.
Tired. Tired to the tiredest degree.
Rudd, that is very encouraging.
No, it is not encouraging. It is not encouraging because Bruce saw Jack at 3:30. We already have at least 3 sightings of Jack alive 1.5 hours later. So fascinating though Bruce's account is, it is utterly, utterly irrelevant.
It is not irrelevant. I need to get the whole picture.
We've got the whole bloody picture. That's the point.
Please get no help.
No, I haven't. I haven't at all, but one more sighting early in the battle does not constitute proof that he is alive.
It's something.
She sits at the drawing room table.
Oh, I'd like a cigarette.
That won't help.
He opens a table drawer. It's empty.
Have you hidden them?
I threw them away.
Oh.
He looks about the room, then makes for the bookshelves.
I know.
He scans the books, takes one out and feels behind it. He pulls out a packet of cigarettes and matches. He puts the book back.
Not mine. Jack's. I found them ages ago. He should have chosen another author. I'm always dipping into Trollope.
Carrie gets up and reaches out a hand. She holds the cigarette box and runs a finger over it gently as she studies it. She looks to Kipling, who stands with a cigarette between his lips. He meets her gaze, then lowers his eyes sheepishly and lights up.
Allah be praised.
That is exactly why you shouldn't smoke.
Fouler than foul.
He slumps into a chair. Carrie puts the cigarettes back behind the book.
I'll find you, Jack.
We will.
Kipling stares wistfully over the top of his gold-rimmed spectacles. Carrie lays a comforting hand on his shoulder. Bird waves the Rolls-Royce off at the house gate. When the car's gone, a blurred image of a man in army uniform is revealed. He limps across to her.
Can I help you?
He removes his hat. It's Beau.
Is this the home of Lieutenant John Kipling?
Beau sits at the circular drawing room table facing Carrie, Bird and Kipling.
The men are after singing your verses at the front, did you know that?
That's very flattering. I believe you knew my son.
Very gentle. Very kind.
What was your platoon?
Guardsman Michael Beau, 7786, 5th Platoon, 2 Company, 2nd Battalion, Irish Guards.
So my son was your platoon commander?
He was always worried about my feet.
Your feet?
Powdered them the day before we went over. They were in a dreadful state on account of the rain.
Was it raining? Was it raining on the day? On the day with Jack, was it raining?
Carrie. Please. Mr. Beau, we have been interviewing Irish guards every day for many months.
You are the first soldier I have met from my son's platoon. If you know something, anything, that will help us, we would be very grateful. To know, one way or the other, would be a great release for the whole family.
Please. Please.
Do you know what I see when I go over the top?
What?
A game of football. The next regiment's attacking the Boche with their rifles shouldered, dribbling a ball across no man's land. And there's a bloke striding out with a walking stick, like a gent on a Sunday jaunt in Phoenix Park. The bullets are all around me. Like bees. A swarm of angry bees buzzing and racing past me here. Jimmy Doyle on one side, the lieutenant on the other. Jimmy goes down. And I'm shouting, we're the only two left, sir. And my lungs are bursting, but we make it into Jerry's frontline trench. And I'm lying there. Trying to breathe. Lying on top of it.
Beau leaps into a trench and falls onto a muddy corpse. He looks round at the face and reels back. O'Leary lies with a bloody wound on his temple. Jack arrives. Beau sits cowering. Jack hauls him up.
Stay close!
Jack grasps the arm of Beau's uniform jacket and leads him along the trench. O'Leary lies mud-spattered and sodden. The rain washes dirt from around his wedding ring. Jack and Beau enter an area of the trench already occupied by British soldiers who are hunkered down. Jack peers through wire which shows through a gash in a concrete trench wall. He sees a machine gun post on a trench ridge high above them.
We can't take that, sir.
That McHugh is why we're here. We're to attack and destroy the machine gun post on Prince Bis 14.
I'm not fucking going anywhere.
You are. We all are.
You're a murderer. You're a fucking murderer.
I'm not a murderer, McHugh. I'm obeying orders. Casey, Joyce, McHugh, right flank. Beau, Flynn with me.
Jack is on his feet, pistol in hand. Beau is still hunkered down, staring ahead.
Come on, boys!
Jack leads the charge. Jack, Beau and McHugh are the only ones left running. They charge towards ladders leading up to the machine gun post. Beau is hit and slides back down the trench. McHugh, not yet at the trench, is hit in the chest. He stops in his tracks, staggers, and drops to his knees. Beau sees McHugh keel over. Jack continues charging. He takes a bullet in the right thigh and drops to one knee. He struggles up again and staggers forward, then takes a bullet in the shoulder. His spectacles fall off with the impact. Jack scrabbles in the mud. The family sit tearfully as they picture the scene. Jack searches for his spectacles. Jack's dirty fingers, only inches away from his spectacles, dig into the grass and mud. Beau trembles and is tearful at the memory.
Go on.
Please.
On the battlefield, Beau gets to his feet. He struggles to the top of the trench to see Jack on his hands and knees.
He was in such pain, sir.
What did you do?
An explosion sends Beau sliding back down the outside of the trench. He sits, dazed. At the Kiplings, he shakes his head and tries to speak.
nose.
Jack finds his spectacles in the mud and puts them on. Kipling stares at Beau darkly. Bird trembles and looks down at the table. Jack sits up on his knees. Blood spurts as several bullets hit him in the chest. He slumps to the ground. Motionless, he lies on his back, head to one side. Kipling stares down fixedly, his lip quivering. A tear rolls down Carrie's white cheek. Bird continues to stare down at the table and fights back sobs. Beau's eyes are lowered and staring. Kipling opens the drawing room door to let Beau out. With the aid of a stick and with Bird holding his arm, Beau hobbles out into the hallway. Kipling watches, then shuts the door. He turns to Carrie, who sits stiffly in a chair at the table.
By all accounts, he was very brave. So few of us have the opportunity to play our part properly. But he did. He achieved what he set out to achieve.
He must have been in such awful pain.
If you talk to wounded soldiers, they'll tell you the pain only sets in later. So he was lucky. It was done with quickly.
Don't tell me he was lucky. He wasn't lucky or brave or happy. Jack was 18 years and one day old. He died in the rain. He couldn't see a thing. He was alone. You can't persuade me there's any glory in that.
I believe there is.
I can't listen to this.
No.
Let go of me.
Do you want me to go down on my knees and admit that I murdered my son? I will if it satisfies you.
Please let go of me.
Do you think a single day passes when I don't consider that possibility? I think about it all the time. All the time. And what truly terrifies me is that if I am to blame, what have I sent him on to? If anything at all. How could I condemn my son to oblivion? How could I do that to Jack?
Kipling closes his eyes tightly. Carrie, whose hands rest on the high mantelpiece, turns to him.
But I miss him.
Kipling shakes his head and removes his spectacles.
Oh.
<Do I?
laughs> He doubles up with grief.
I can feel his head on my chest. I can feel his thick hair under my fingers. I can hear him laugh. I can feel his heat against me.
Kipling straightens up and forces a determined expression.
We'll manage.
Carrie regains a little composure.
Oh, yes, we'll manage. I don't doubt that.
She looks at him through tear-filled eyes.
I'll go find Bird. Will you be all right?
Yes, thank you.
Kipling lowers his eyes as she passes him and walks out. Kipling stares ahead sadly. Carrie comforts her weeping daughter. She stands with her arm around Bird, who is seated. Carrie strokes Bird's arm comfortingly and lays her free hand gently on her daughter's head as she sobs. Night. Carrie enters Jack's room. She's carrying a lit oil lamp. Her eyes cast about the room as she walks over to a wardrobe and opens it. She runs a hand gently over the jackets that are hanging up. She selects one and puts it to her face to breathe in the scent. With the jacket draped about her shoulders, Carrie lies on her side on Jack's bed and stares ahead, a faint smile on her face. Kipling sits in darkness at the drawing room table. He rises and walks slowly out of the room and up the wood-panelled stairs. He turns out a gaslight halfway up the stairs. Kipling enters Jack's room where Carrie lies asleep. He slips the jacket off her shoulders and leans over her gently.
Bed.
His arm around Carrie's waist, Kipling helps her from the room. Wearing a long white sleeveless nightdress, Carrie gets into bed. Kipling, in a white nightshirt, slips under the covers beside her and flops back on the pillow. They both lie on their backs, eyes open.
He would have found a way, even if he tried to stop him. He was where he wanted to be. I know that.
Kipling turns his head to look at her.
I let him down.
Carrie turns her head slowly and stares at him gently. Kipling blinks as he returns her gaze.
Do you want a story?
Yes, please.
Carrie turns on her side with her back facing Kipling, who snuggles in and rests his chin on her shoulder. He rests a hand gently on her arm.
Well, this, O best beloved, is another story of the high and far-off times.
Blue sky dotted with clouds, the Rolls-Royce speeds through lush green countryside. Servants let Kipling in to see the king.
I didn't time you, I'm afraid.
Of course not. It was awful slow, anyway. I was stuck behind a herd of cattle for half an hour.
Bugger all you can do about that.
The king, in uniform, rises from his chair, stares at Kipling, then approaches with his hand outstretched. The men shake hands.
Who'd have a son? Breaks your heart.
I was so sorry to hear your news, sir.
Thank you. The fact that he was the youngest made it worse.
How old was he?
13. He was lying on the floor of his bedroom. Do you mind me telling it?
Not at all.
Lying on his back.
The king turns away, biting back tears.
He just had a fit.
Dead.
But he was still warm. And that was a great relief. I'd have hated to have had.
The king looks away again as he weeps.
I'd have hated to have found him cold.
Does that seem odd?
No.
Kipling stares sympathetically at the king, whose back is still turned towards him.
Have you news of my boy Jack? Not this tide. When do you think that he'll come back? Not with this wind blowing and this tide. Has anyone else had word of him? Not this tide. For what is sunk will hardly swim, not with this wind blowing and this tide. Oh dear, what comfort can I find? None this tide nor any tide.
Carrion bird pick roses in their garden.
Except he did not shame his kind. Not even with that wind blowing and that tide. Then hold your head up, all the more this tide and every tide.
Jack, in uniform, walks down the garden path to the car with Kipling.
Because he was the son you bore. And gave to that wind blowing and that tide.
A silver holder with pink roses in it stands between two framed photographs on the mantelpiece at the Kiplings. One is of Josie, the other of Jack in his lieutenant's uniform. ITFC audio description by Helen Vasey.